washed his hands and sealed his face. Pleased to meet you, hope you guess my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Stuck around St. Petersburg.
Welcome to another episode of the Art Salon Podcast. I am your host, Nico Herrano. Before we get going, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and share our talks with your friends. Follow us on Instagram at the Art Salon to keep up with our latest guests and announcements. And finally, if you enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star rating on your preferred podcast platform. It helps direct others to the show and makes us feel good about what we're doing here. Today's guest is Maggie Kilgore. She's the Molson Professor of English Language here at McGill University, with her main areas of interest being Milton and Shakespeare, and the reception of the classics, especially Virgil and Ovid, and the Renaissance, the poetry of Abraham Cowley, Renaissance European literature, classical literature, the Gothic novel, and cannibalism. I'm going to read a quick bio of Maggie for those of you that are not familiar with her from the McGill website. Though my intellectual development has taken many odd twists and turns, my work explores questions of identity, creativity, literary history, and the concept of tradition. In my books and essays, I have traced the representation of the cannibal from the ancient world to the present and followed the reception of ancient literature through the 17th to 19th centuries. I have written on classical literature, contemporary film, the 18th century and contemporary Gothic, 16th century drama, and 17th century poetry. I find changing directions and orientations stimulating and intellectually renewing. At the same time, I always find myself returning to the writings of John Milton, in many ways the pivotal figure in English literature. Milton fulfills and reinterprets the classics in a way that prepared the way for almost all literary development since: the novel, romantic poetry, Gothic literature, sci-fi, drama, children's literature, even graphic novels. He is at the center of an English creative tradition which is not fixed and monumental, but is always being remade and pushed in new directions. After more than 30 years of reading him, I find him endlessly exciting and, for a dead guy, astonishingly surprising. There will be a link to the rest of Maggie's bio at the bottom of the podcast info, but I thought reading this would give us an introduction to the subject that we will be dealing with today. Although our discussion with Maggie falls into the off-topic part of this podcast, which features Andres Caro as co-host, this really is an on-topic conversation since it deals with culture and with the arts, and more specifically with John Milton. I first met Maggie at McGill University, where I attended as a musician, but I ended up in her class in the introduction of Paradise Lost because it had been a book that I had heard cultured people should read. I never expected that this would be my favorite class in my 4 years doing my undergraduate at McGill. It was truly fascinating, and as you'll see in this discussion, Maggie is one of the most compelling advocates for works like these. If you have never read Paradise Lost, maybe this will be a good primer. And if you have read it many times, you'll find it new things. I certainly found a lot of new things on this discussion, and Maggie corrected me on some of my own interpretations of the poem, and it was truly amazing to revisit this with her and with Andres. Andres and I are both very fond of cluster reading. This is where you read multiple books at the same time or about a single subject through multiple books in a short period of time. As it happens, as I was reading Paradise Lost, I was also reading an interesting historical study on Stalin and the Terror by Martin Amis called Coba the Dread. Although this book seemingly has nothing to do with Paradise Lost, it was interesting. At the very end of it, there's a short excerpt from an essay that he had written in a letter to his dad, Kingsley Amis. And I want to share it because I don't think it would have been as rich if I hadn't also been just studying Paradise Lost again. He says, "Although Eden then is the goal of human life, it remains strictly an imaginative goal, not a social construct, even as a possibility. The argument applies also to the literary utopias, which are not the dreary fascist states popularizers try to extrapolate from them, but rather analogies of the well-termed paired mind, rigidly disciplined, highly selective as regards art, and so on. Thus Blake, like Milton, saw the hidden world, the animal world in which we are condemned to live, as the inevitable complements to man's imagination. Man was never meant to escape death, jealousy, pain, libido, what Wordsworth calls the human heart by which we live. Perhaps this is why Blake paints the created Adam with a serpent already coiled around his thigh. Like many important works of art, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Bach cantatas, most of Shakespeare's works, many paintings by Michelangelo and Da Vinci, the Bible, Paradise Lost is a central accomplishment of Western culture. And as such, it should be a work that everyone reads at least once. Every time I read it, it gives me something new, and it feels so modern, so current, because it deals with what it means to be human. Without wanting to delay our conversation, I leave you with Maggie Kilgore. Maggie, I met you at CalArts. I mean, at McGill, not CalArts. Obviously, CalArts would never hire somebody as prestigious as you. But I met you at McGill, and I think you, I told you this, my favorite class in the world was your class, and I came to it almost too late. I had been so disappointed in my music school that when we discussed the arts, it was kind of like bass. And then going to the English department and other departments, I got the classes I wanted to get in both mythology and literature and all that. But your class by far stands like as a big memory. And the class I'm talking about is Paradise Lost. And I ended up in that class because I had always been told that this was one of the books you read, which seems like a weird thing now. It seems like that's not how people think anymore. But I'm very glad I did it. It still remains like one of my favorite books. And I also have to say that you taught me how to read poetry in that class in many ways. And so I thought this would be an amazing get together. Andres is starting his first reading of Paradise Lost. And he's a big fan of Shakespeare. Like I said, and when we started talking, I said, you have to read Milton. So I think this will be a real treat. But, you know, we had just talked about maybe going into the context of John Milton's life and how Paradise Lost comes together, because in this reading, I think I felt it more than ever how much of a Republican poem it is, but also a lot of Areopagitica is written in, especially like in book 10. I felt a lot with Eve, and it's very strange to do that in a poem that's about like the fall of man. So why don't you tell us a little bit about John Milton, the time he was coming about in both artistically and politically, and how it influenced his creations.
Well, I'd like to just start with just a few, you know, sort of a bit of a response to your introduction, which is really lovely. And of course, you know, the thing that every teacher wants to hear, and especially a teacher right now, when there is so much, people hear so much about how the arts or the studying, the critical analysis of literature especially, is not something worthy of study at a higher level. And I think your situation, you know, sort of is one that I do find among other students who come to university often taking, alas, more practical things than music, like economics or, you know, management, and do feel that, you know, they're not being stimulated as thinkers, as people, and they want to take something that will give them a bit more. And they turn to literature because, well, I think, again, part of the bad reputation about studying literature is there is a bit of an assumption that we're all literate, we can read. So why do you have to go to university to do that? You know, we don't know how to perform brain surgery, so we can understand that that might be a useful skill. But we think that, you know, reading literature, you know, that's just something that we all do. But actually, it's very complicated, and it's especially complicated with writers like Milton and even Shakespeare, though we don't know about it as much with Shakespeare, because although that's changing, alas, in the high schools, still most of us at in the English-speaking world at the high school level are taught how to read Shakespeare. And it takes years because, you know, and I can think of my high school classes when we had to go through, you know, sentence by sentence. But once you get it, it's suddenly quite magical. And I think that part of the allure is also the sense that you're really learning something, your mind is growing as you're expanding to read things that on the surface are almost like, you know, these mysteries that, you know, sort of that you can't get at. But then once you start understanding how the imagination works, you enter a whole other world. And learning how to read Milton is, and Shakespeare, and, you know, other great complicated writers, you know, sort of, there are many of them, you know, sort of through the ages, anywhere from Homer and picking up to Joyce, but beyond that as well. And once you've been introduced to that, you start realizing that there is a more complicated way in which we use language, that understanding really helps, you know, sort of train our brains to think in new ways. And I think, you know, although there are many great writers with this, I think Milton is particularly, you know, useful for this, partly because he does seem so challenging. And one of the reasons he seems challenging, I think, is precisely that people think that he's so embedded in his time. One of the myths of Shakespeare, of course, that was carefully constructed in the 18th century, is that he's the universal genius of all time. You know, as Ben Jonson said, you know, he's our Shakespeare. And, you know, so, and one of the exciting things to be seen since the time the plays were written is the way they've been interpreted and, you know, sort of restaged. That theater itself is something that is always, you know, sort of changing the works. The performances of Shakespeare today are nothing like the performances of Shakespeare in Shakespeare's time, or in the 18th century or the 19th century. But there's this myth of kind of universality that, you know, he could speak to any time. And Milton seems so embedded in his time. And that's, I think, what actually makes him, you know, more relevant in a way. Now, it's partly, I think, that these days there are ways in which Milton's time is speaking to us. You know, during COVID, there were so many analogies between, you know, the Great Plague epidemic in 1665, though there were many others through the 17th century. And also, too, with just the polarization of politics globally is reminding people of other times when the, you know, world or nations have turned to civil war. And in many ways, the English Civil War is a very chilling analogy, because it was also one that kind of happened, you know, in a way that people would not have predicted a few years before. And, you know, the events kind of got out of control. And that's a very sobering reminder today when we look at what's happening and think, part of us thinks, oh no, you know, we're civilized people, we won't have civil war. But it can happen. And that's what's really chilling. But it's not just the parallels between our time and the 17th century, I think, that make Milton relevant. When my students, you know, one of the great things about teaching Milton is that obviously it takes a certain bravery to choose Milton and what to come. And you do have to know that, yes, this is going to be a challenge. And I think there are a lot of obstacles for students to overcome, you know, preconceptions about what Paradise Lost will be like, but also preconceptions about Christianity, about Protestantism, you know, that all of these things about, you know, the sort of the mythology of Genesis, that I think that it's seen as, you know, sort of very, as something that is very elite and only belongs to a very specific constituency. So for example, I mean, you know, there have been, through the centuries, there have been writers and critics who have said that, you know, you have to be a Christian to read Paradise Lost. And I actually think the opposite. I think that it's better not to be a Christian, because Milton, in a way, is really scrutinizing Christianity as a mythological system. I mean, he would not have seen it in this way, but I think we can. And thinking about, you know, putting it under pressure. And you can only see that in a way, I think, when you stand, or you can see that better, I shouldn't say only, but you can see that better standing outside and just thinking, you know, that he takes the story of Genesis not because he thinks it's the story that is, you know, part of defining, you know, sort of a people, but rather because he thinks it's the story that it speaks to everyone. I mean, the story that's told in Genesis is really a kind of universal tale. It appears in different forms across many mythologies. I mean, in which there is this assumption that there was a time when the world was first created that was a lot better, and now it's a lot worse. And the question for religion is, how does this happen? You know, especially if you want to believe in a good God who is also omnipotent. How can you have a good God who is an omnipotent who lets these dreadful things happen? You know, either he's not omnipotent and he's just, you know, kind of not in control, or he's not very good. That this is a real problem here. And, you know, the story in Genesis, which traces the blame to humans, is an attempt to solve it, but an attempt that obviously has never completely worked, because otherwise there wouldn't have been so many interpretations of Genesis and trying to make it work. And this is what Milton is doing, and he's thinking about it. He's thinking about it because it is related to his own situation. I mean, there are different ways in which we could interpret the relationship between Paradise Lost to Milton's historical moment. But Milton was someone who believed that the overthrow of the monarchy would allow England to create a juster government. And his idea of a just government would not satisfy many of us today. It was not the same kind of democratic model. Milton was an intellectual snob to a certain extent, and was influenced by, you know, sort of ideas from the past, including from Plato, of course, of the idea of a government by some kind of, you know, benign, trained and worthy elite, that, you know, a full democratic government, I think, would have terrified him. Of course, you know, with the education and, in fact, with what he saw around him in the 17th century, in many ways, that's quite understandable, that there was a lot of momentum from Protestant radical groups who were in the army. And basically, they were taking control through military insurrection. And that is not always the most reassuring for a good government. So Milton was, you know, worried about that. But Milton saw what was happening, you know, in many ways as a very positive thing. But we don't know, you know, he worked for the English overthrew the monarchy in 1649, and they established a government, you know, gradually under the power of Oliver Cromwell, who became had been the second in command, actually, in the army. But because of circumstances, increasingly came under control and increasingly became himself more monarchical. In fact, because things were kind of up for grabs, he was able to take more power than the king previously had had. And Milton worked for this government, although during this time he lost his eyesight completely. He'd been having trouble with his eyes since for about 10 years before then, at least. And he lost it completely. But he continued, you know, doing some work for the government and clearly, you know, sort of supporting it, whatever qualms he might have had. And when Cromwell died in 1659 or 1658, it must have been, you know, sort of a bit of a, it was, you know, would have been a shock for him, but also one that he thought was a possibility for, you know, perhaps getting the government back on track and creating something that, you know, came closer to what he wanted. The restoration of the monarchy in 1660 was a disaster for him, and you know, he could have been executed, although he wasn't. But what's interesting is we don't know exactly when he started to write Paradise Lost. I mean, it's tempting to say that he wrote it in the wake of the restoration and the collapse of his political dreams. But it's more likely that he was already working on it, you know, sort of earlier in the 1650s, that even with, you know, the monarchy overcome and the interregnum established and the protectorate established, that he was, that this topic really, you know, sort of concerned him, that he really wanted to understand. And I think also, you know, that what worried him here too was trying to find a way of understanding why dreams often turn into nightmares, or why they don't work out, what the problems are. Now, you know, we don't know, of course, you know, at the end of his life, if he still had hope for a restoration of the non-monarchical system, because the last years in which he lived, the monarchy was still very, very precarious, and there, Charles II didn't have an heir. There were still, you know, sort of groups, you know, sort of agitating to overthrow him. There was the plague, there was the fire of London, there, you know, other, you know, huge turmoils. So it was a very, very tumultuous time, and again, rather like our own. And I think what's, just to come back to the poem, one of what makes Paradise Lost so really remarkable is that it is a poem that is rooted very much in a very specific historical moment and in a specific human being's experience of that. You know, one of the things that Milton, one of the way Milton develops the epic that was rather different from what had been done before by the classical writers or even Renaissance writers, was in his creation of a real character for the narrator. And I think one of the, you know, the narrator, just following the narrator through Paradise Lost, there are long invocations beginning some of the books, and he builds up a character and a personality. And I think that one of the things that draws attention to is that this poem is about a very particular, specific, subjective historical experience, but it's also universal. That he's mythologizing his own life in a way that, you know, sort of allows him also to, you know, to find kind of solace in sharing it and recognizing that his feelings of disappointment, of loss, are ones that are built into the human condition, as the myth of Genesis explains. It, so ironically, in a way, its historical specificity is what also gives it its ability to reach us today. Because it just does remind us that, you know, we don't live in universals. We live in historical, you know, sort of moments. And they do affect us and they shape us for better or worse. The way I teach Milton is shaped by the time today. And you know, we're not ahistorical creatures at all. And even Shakespeare wasn't.
I think I'll let Andres go on with this, but I think I wanted to say something because I think it'll help. I want to hear something from Andres, but you said something that was very interesting to me about how modern his time seemed to us. And the other book that I know is very important to Andres, but also important to me, and we've discussed it, is Leviathan. And it's interesting to see these two contemporaries so preoccupied with existence in a way that's, like you said, very, these books to me are very modern today. I don't know if they were modern in 1990, but they feel modern now, for sure. But anyway, Andres, go ahead.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about that, but now that you mention it, Nico, it seems as though Leviathan, it's like the sequel of Paradise Lost. Of course, it was written before, but in a sense, the original myth of Hobbes is the sort of man that comes after the fall. In a way, it's like these very, and the world that he describes is this very chaotic world after God has forsaken it. But I wanted to ask you one question, Professor, about the form of the poem, because it is divided in 12 chants, or how do you say?
Books, yeah.
Books, of course, which follows the Aeneid by Virgil, which was like this imperial poem, this poem written by a new by a poet that wanted to consolidate or to help consolidate a new political system, which was the empire, centered on a very powerful and interesting figure, which was Caesar, Octavian. So I don't know, because he finished the book after the restoration, so in a way it must be a pessimistic book, but the shape of the book, it's very optimistic. It seems like it's an epic, and but it's not an epic that ends well, it seems to me. So I wanted to ask you about how do you see the form of the poem with the historical context, with the political purpose of Milton?
Well, first of all, maybe we need to do a podcast on Virgil, because I disagree with you in many ways about Virgil. For one thing, I don't
probably
think...
because I am wrong. No worries.
But you know, you're saying what people have assumed about Virgil for a long time, and you're absolutely right in that, you know, Virgil was in many ways the model for the epic, which, I mean, to us is weird because, you know, we think of Virgil after Homer, and today Homer is much sexier. I mean, there have been wonderful new translations of Homer. There have been some good new translations of Virgil as well. In classical scholarship, though, there's been a lot of interest and sort of scrutinizing, you know, sort of Virgil's actual relationship to the Augustan order. Because although, you know, is it a story with a happy ending? I mean, it ends with a very violent death, not of the hero, of course. The hero is killing him, but it's not the hero's finest moment. It's when he's, you know, sort of going kind of berserk and killing someone, and it ends very soberly. I mean, it could have, if you wanted to make it a happy ending, which some later critics did. There's a wonderful rewriting in the Renaissance by a young fellow who wrote a 13th book for the Aeneid in which the hero gets married, and so that brings it to a really happy ending. But this is really quite sober, and the idea that Virgil was in fact very critical of the Augustan Empire is not just a contemporary, you know, fallacy. That there were, Virgil was, you know, translated and reinterpreted during the 17th century as a kind of contest about whether he was really supporting the Augustan order, which was seen as a kind of precursor to a monarchy, or whether he was suspicious of it. And also, other classical writers who were less, less endorsing of imperialism and monarchy is the issue here, not really empire, a monarchy, such as Lucan, are also very important at this time. And remember, Paradise Lost was originally published in 10 books, which is the structure that Lucan used. But eventually Milton divided into 12, and again, there's lots of disagreement about that. So I think, you know, Milton is a superb classicist. He reads also, of course, Greek and writes in Greek when he wants to. So there's a lot of Homer, there's a lot of Lucan, that Virgil, you know, and he's also really reinterpreting, you know, the classical works in ways that other writers have done as well. And if you were writing an epic in the Renaissance, Virgil was certainly the model that you looked back to, but not necessarily to enforce and agree with, but often, more importantly, to disagree with. And, you know, of course, Virgil had been alive during a period of civil war. And in his early works, in the eclogues, there's just a lot of, you know, sort of, you know, references to some of the devastation that took place because of the civil war. And the idea of civil war really haunts the Aeneid. And the last battle, in many ways, is kind of set up as a kind of, you know, civil war. You know, the problem that Lucan, who's a later Republican poet who wrote under Nero and had to commit suicide because it was discovered his role in a plot to overthrow Nero was discovered, so he never finished. He wrote started writing an epic on the Civil War. The point of his epic on the Civil War and a civil war is that there are no happy endings. There are no winners and losers because everyone loses. And I think that Lucan, in a way, looks back and sees that message in Virgil. And in the 17th century, especially writing through the lens of the experience of civil war and the cost, there is that kind of recognition. One thing that happens in the 17th century, and it's not just in England because of the civil war, all of Europe has been ravaged by war too, is that that the idea that, you know, we sometimes have the misconception that the epic celebrates killing. It never does. In Homer, I mean, Odysseus just wants to get home as fast as possible. And he never wanted to be in the war in the first place. And, you know, even in the Iliad, which seems to be just, you know, kind of massive slaughters, there's this lament for loss with, you know, with over such a trivial thing. And the loss of these great heroes, the loss of so many different lives, that, you know, war is never celebrated. But in the 17th century, just one of the reasons Milton is thinking about writing this kind of epic is that people don't want an epic celebrating battle. I mean, basically, people thought the epic was dead. And to come back to Hobbes, you know, sort of in many ways, by returning to epic, Milton looked like he was old-fashioned, as opposed to Hobbes being, for better or worse, the man of the future. Not a future that everyone liked, but, you know, sort of foreseeing the kind of world that was coming. And Milton, in writing an epic, was seen, you know, as perhaps, you know, kind of a little bit anachronistic. But I think, you know, sort of in a way, you know, both of them have been enormously influential. But Milton's influence has, you know, sort of shown up in so many ways in both literature and also in politics, in thinking about revolution. You know, so the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the American Revolution, that Milton has got great lines for them from Areopagitica, as Nico mentioned. And so he's been inspiring for political action, as well as just, you know, inspiring other writers. So there, I think, you know, Hobbes and Milton are really interesting to put as these kind of parallel, you know, sort of traditions that, you know, parallel responses to the 17th century mess. Of course, Hobbes is, he's about 20 years older than Milton, I guess, almost exactly. And, you know, see, famously he said, you know, he was born the day that the Armada attacked, and, you know, sort of that influenced everything, that he lived in fear. And I think, you know, sort of that, to come back to your point about Paradise Lost, I think Milton, though he must have at some points and should have at other points, does not come across as someone who lived in fear or is motivated by fear. His motives are something else. And I think this is what makes Paradise Lost so strikingly different from the Leviathan, is just that sense, despite everything that's happened, despite the mess that happened, you know, in England, of hope, of possibility, and that I'm glad that your first reading of Paradise Lost, that comes through, because sometimes, you know, it's always not always easy to see, but I think that, you know, most of Paradise Lost is really about being happy, being in a world that's happy. And it's not just that was what we used to be like, and now we're in a Hobbesian state of nature and life is nasty, brutish, and short. It's, you know, hopefully, you know, sort of that this is something that we want to try to find in the future. And again, that's why I think he's been inspiring for political movements, because he is a source of hope that, you know, even if we can't achieve it, Milton didn't. And one of his role models is the biblical figure of Moses, of course, who leads his people out of captivity, but he himself can't enter the promised land. You know, the leader never quite gets what he's been trying to do, but maybe someone else will.
And of course, part of the narrative is the unwritten acknowledgement that all of these lost came to an end with Jesus, with somebody saved us, in a sense. So,
although that's the problem for Christianity, because Jesus came and he saved us, but everything is still a mess.
Of course.
Lost deals with that. You know, that this is the problem. He was supposed to save us. Why aren't things better? And the Bible's answer to that is, aha, you have to wait for the second coming. But again, it kind of helps, but it doesn't really. It doesn't help in sort of daily life. And I think they think for Milton, again, that's one of the things that Paradise Lost is trying to understand. That paradox is that we know we've been saved, but we're still not, and the experience is the way it is. And it's can't just say, oh, well, I'll be miserable now, but, you know, in the afterworld, I'll be happy. Although, you know, some people do and some people have to. But Milton doesn't want that either. And, you know, the poem is, that's, I think, you know, more encouraging of a kind of active attempt to find some way of making the world better. And one of the things that I think is one of the great things about Paradise Lost, although frustrating, is that it doesn't offer us a kind of blueprint for that, you know, sort of that, okay, the world is awful, but, you know, sort of if you do this, 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 and this, you know, everything will be fine. That what Milton is trying to do is make us think in new ways and imagine new ways to expand our minds, to imagine new ways. So someone out there, one of these readers is perhaps going to find something that Milton himself can't imagine. That there is a kind of deliberate attempt, I think, to kind of stimulate thinking, that in imaginative thinking in ways that, you know, sort of may go forward, even if they're not ways that Milton himself could have foreseen. And that's the way, of course, things work.
Yeah, I had never put two things together that you just said, but it's so true that it's so palpable that Civil War has no winners in Milton. I just realized, like, the very epic war that he describes is the war between angels and Satan's fall. And the interesting thing is, I always thought, and I thought again in this reading, it's such a pointless war, and God knows it. It's like, go over there and play. And when you've had enough play and you all realize this is pointless, I will send my son to very swiftly end this. But ultimately, from the get-go, it's such a pointless affair. Like, no, he knows it's pointless. Everyone knows it's pointless. And I think that's something so fascinating. And then the other thing you said about the positivity in Milton, that also is like a weird thing to put together. This is what makes this poem so complex. It's, everyone is a little bit positive in the book, like even the demons, you know, like in the first book, there's this whole explanation of how, even though this is bad, it's good. Like we get to be away from God and create our own heaven here, away from every aspect of it has its negative moment. And then it's kind of like, but if you see it from this angle, it's all going to be great. And I find that super, maybe it's a good segue into getting into the poem itself. And I don't know how you want to get into it, but I was thinking maybe since the book opens this way, why don't we talk a little bit about the character of Satan himself? Because I told you this when we last talked, like, I keep thinking at every reading as I get older, I'm going to find Satan less seductive. And I'm going to be like, aha, he was a fool this whole time. But at least for now, I keep reading it and Satan is the most compelling character. And it seems like Milton is pointing at him as the most compelling character because he opens the poem. So from the get-go, we are kind of tinted to his point of view. So I don't know if that's a good place to start, but I'll let you just go with that.
Everything has to start with Satan. But I think also, you know, one of the major questions is why did Milton choose to start with Satan? If the poem is, as Milton himself says at the very beginning, to justify the ways of God to man, you know, he clearly knew that by putting Satan on stage first, and he did imagine Paradise Lost first as a play and tried a few versions of it, most of which do not seem particularly promising, and in them wouldn't have had the potential for drama that the epic does. But putting Satan up front is an incredibly daring thing to do, because he does immediately grab the spotlight and grab our attention and command our sympathy. And the other daring thing that Milton does is he often puts in Satan's mouth the kinds of concerns that, you know, sort of readers of the poem and of Genesis should have, you know, what, you know, sort of questions about why did God prohibit the tree? This doesn't seem like a good idea. Why didn't God stop the fall? Why is God letting all of this happen? That paradise doesn't seem, you know, sort of paradise. And I think what Milton is doing, and oh, the other thing is, I'm actually really glad to see that Satan hasn't lost his charm on you, because I think one of the problems with, you know, sort of, there's one way of reading the poem is to open the poem and see that there's a figure whose name is Satan. And immediately you decide, of course, bad guy, you know, sort of don't trust him. He is evil. And that simplifies the poem because it makes you immune to the real charm of Satan, which is part of Milton's point here. That when I said earlier that Milton wants to really think about the issues of Christianity, I mean, I think he also wants to think deeply about moral issues that often get buried in daily life. You know, we use the terms good and evil often very glibly, as if we kind of knew what they were. And Milton really wants us to think about what is good and what is evil. And what he does that's so daring is that he could have created Satan in the mold of, you know, medieval Satans on stage or in pictures, Dante's Lucifer, this three-headed monster who's a cannibal and, you know, clearly is bad news. And if the devil looked like that, no one would do anything bad because what's the temptation? And one of the things that Milton wants us to really wrestle with is what's wrong with Satan? Because that really is the central problem. Where did things go wrong? If it just looks wrong from the start, then it's all too simple. That instead we have this very complex character. And I'm not going to try to answer that here because, I mean, I could give one answer, but there are millions of answers. I think we kind of grapple. But I think it's really important to have that grappling, which also has to admit that there's so much that's attractive in Satan. Milton also puts in Satan's mouth a lot of things that Milton himself believed. He sounds like Milton a lot of the time. And because of this, you know, the Romantics, Blake and to a slightly lesser extent, you know, Shelley, think that Milton identified with Satan. And that's still, you know, a reading that comes up. And to a certain extent, I agree with that. I think Milton, you know, sort of identifies part of himself with Satan because, you know, it's easy. You know, there's part of us that, you know, the point of the poem is that there is something in human nature that partakes of that demonic energy. And I think the harder part in the poem, in many ways, is also making us think about what is the good. You know, people are charmed by Satan. Most readers are pretty put off by God in book three when he appears. Again, that's so daring. You've had two books of Satan, action hero. He's commander. He's getting, he's rallying the troops in the burning pit. He's flying out of hell to liberate, set his people free. And then you zoom up to heaven and there is God, and he's just like, you know, the images of God. I mean, this is the way I think of him in my mind, that Milton doesn't describe him, but I kind of see him with a big white beard and flowing robes, and he's kind of sitting there looking down on everyone and foreseeing that Adam and Eve are going to fall and kind of berating them in advance. That Milton doesn't make him cuddly. He makes him omniscient, but in terms of the reader's sympathy and empathy, there's nothing there, which is, of course, is part of the point. I mean, he's a transcendent God, so he's beyond us. I think Milton does try to make us, to complicate that idea of the good through the construction of the Son, Jesus Christ, as a separate character who has rather different kinds of features and represents a side of God, the human side, the side that's incarnated, that, you know, he hopes that we can identify with. But I think also, and this is where I'd probably want to fight with you a bit over Satan is the most compelling character. I think he also, Milton is very, and this hasn't been given enough attention, it really only started getting attention in the 1970s because of feminist criticism of Milton, the characters of Adam and Eve, is that, you know, that in usual elaborations of the Genesis myth. Adam and Eve are just, well, they're archetypes. They are the first man and the first woman. So they're really flat characters, which is, you know, sort of something similar to a certain extent, epic, you know, characters who are a bit static as well. They don't develop. They just, you know, they're perfect and then they fall. And Milton actually, in his representation of Adam and Eve in book four, especially, and well, actually books four through nine till the fall, tries to bring them to life and make them, you know, as much as possible, people with whom we can identify. I mean, given that their lives are very different from ours and their situation are very different, but they're a couple. They are, you know, sort of negotiating their relationship. They have a history. They had a courtship. They both tell the stories of that courtship, and they're very different. It's kind of that classic, you know, when you ask a couple how they met and they have completely different stories. And they have quite different characters too. They're both speaking in the verse form that Milton has chosen, so that may make it harder sometimes for readers to be attentive. But once you start looking at it, you see that, you know, they have different ways of seeing the world. But you also see that as the poem proceeds, that unlike, you know, sort of most representations of the couple, they're dynamic. They grow and they change. The eve of you know, sort of Eve's decision to leave in book nine, you know, sort of is something that comes out of the developments and things that she learns while we see her. So we see them very much in a process of growing. And this is one reason why Paradise Lost was so influential on the novel, and especially because the novel was concerned with domestic relations and marriage questions. And so looking at the relationship between Adam and Eve was, you know, sort of instrumental, I think, in you know, sort of designing the novel. So, but I think it's also, just to come back to the point about, you know, making Satan compelling, it's less, you know, it's God is, there's only so much you can do with God for, you know, various reasons. But I think it's with Adam and Eve that Milton has to make us feel that Satan is doing something evil, that he's destroying something that was valuable. And so in a lot of ways, Eden is the test for readers, that Milton has to convince us that Adam and Eve live in a world that it was tragic to have lost. Mm. And I think, again, often my students or readers generally will come to the poem with the assumption that the fall was a good thing. And the fall was a good thing because life in Eden was really boring and women were subservient and, you know, all the food was raw. And Milton really wants to, I'm not saying he succeeds, because, you know, but Milton really wants to make us think that this is a paradise where, you know, sort of one could have been happy, maybe with a little bit of twinkling. You know, I think we can all, you know, sort of find things that we think are lacking or shouldn't be in Milton's paradise. You know, there aren't any dogs there, for one thing. So I think that's...
I love that. Yeah, I agree with you that what you're saying, like Adam and Eve are very compelling, but I've found in this reading that what I find compelling, like they keep telling us that they're made in the image of God. But what I find most compelling about Adam and Eve are the things that are, it's almost like they're actually made in the image of Satan in some ways. Like from book seven, they're talking about like Adam's thirst for knowledge is so large that he doesn't take, it's almost like, yeah, okay, I hear you, angel. Sure. I'll only know enough, but he wants more. And the same with like Eve is super compelling in book nine. It's that defiance of authority that's telling you not to improve yourself that I find most compelling in Adam and Eve.
That's there's nothing wrong with knowledge in Paradise Lost. In fact, in, you know, sort of that God sends Raphael, an angel, down in book seven to give them knowledge. And book seven to nine, he tells them an awful lot of stuff. He tells them how the world was created, tells them, you know, how, you know, they were created. He tells them about how Satan fell. He answers all of Adam's questions. There's nothing wrong with knowledge. And in fact, when, you know, sort of after Raphael, when Raphael starts speaking, one of the first things that Adam learns from him is precisely that. Hold on, I'm just going to find the passage that I want, in which Raphael the angel comes down from heaven and sits with Adam and Eve and starts talking, because he's supposed to explain to them some things that will help them resist Satan. And what this is in book five, what Adam responds to after Raphael answers the first question is, he says, "Well, hast thou taught the way that might direct our knowledge? And the scale of nature set from center to circumference, whereon by contemplation of created things, we may by steps ascend to God." So, you know, that what they are learning is that through knowledge, they're going to rise to God. It's not knowledge that they're denied. It's eating the tree of knowledge. And they're not exactly the same thing. And is Satan really interested in knowledge? He's interested in overthrowing authority. But one of the things that's interesting, I'm not sure I can find the passage immediately. One of the things that Adam and Eve are interested in are the stars. And Milton kind of flirts with, you know, questions about, you know, sort of whether there are other worlds that they're inhabited and stuff. So Satan, during his journey in book three, is he's going from hell to earth and he's flying through, and he looks and he sees the stars. And Milton says that he passes stars distant, but nigh hand seemed other worlds, or other worlds they seemed, or happy isles. And then just goes on, but who dwelt there, he stayed not to inquire. Satan doesn't really have a lot of curiosity about things. In fact, he's got a rather limited imagination. It's all focused on power. Who has power? When he sees the sun in book four, his first thoughts are, it reminds him of himself, but also God and power, that the sun looks like a god up there. Then in book nine, when he comes down to earth, he thinks that the earth is a kind of god, that it's the center of the universe, that he's very status conscious. He's very hierarchically conscious, that where Adam and Eve are really interested in how things are ascending and moving up to God, Satan just, he's really unhappy that he's down here. He wants to be up there. And that's really what he's fixated on. He's not really kind of, it seems kind of intuitive to say, because he is such a compelling character. And I think for us, he's so imaginatively inspiring. But himself, he's actually imaginatively rather limited. He keeps on coming back to the same thing. And he always comes to the same conclusion. He has a wonderful soliloquy in book four, where he's really quite honest with himself. And I think it's one of the moments where, you know, one of the last moments where he's really, really appealing, because he seems to be, and it's very dramatic. It's like Hamlet, or, you know, soliloquies like that. He seems to really be honestly confronting what he's done and thinking about that. And yet it doesn't get him anywhere, because he keeps on coming back to the same thing. He's thinking about, okay, well, maybe he could go back to heaven. And he says, oh, then at last relent. Is there no place left for repentance, none for pardon left, none left by submission? And that word disdain forbids me, and my dread of shame. You know, this is an odd way in which, you know, sort of he's thinking about perhaps changing, but he sees that his own character is kind of fixed. You know, he sees himself as someone who's kind of fixed and already shaped and can't change. That if he could, if he says, as he goes on, that if he came back, he would just end up doing the same thing. And I mean, on the one hand, we could say he's being honest about his own limitations. But on the other hand, isn't he also kind of reinforcing those limitations and making them? Because I think we all like to think that we might change. If we make a mistake, we might change our minds. And Milton is really interested in characters who make mistakes and then recover. There's in book 5 and 6, he tells the story of one of the angels who was misled by Satan and rebelled with him. And then halfway through, he discovers what Satan is really up to, and he goes back to God. And this is clearly seen as a kind of, you know, sort of role model that, you know, sort of, we all make mistakes. We all fall. We make errors. And part of the question of the poem then is, when does an error become really big, you know, and is not just something that you can go back on? But it's not an easy answer, especially in the case of Satan, because in fact, throughout the poem, in many ways, there are different times where it's also hard not to think that Satan really does have an opportunity to do something different. But he always, it's, you know, and there's something kind of obsessive about his character, that he's almost, you know, there's an old Greek saying, character is fate. And it's almost like he does feel like, you know, sort of his character is, he has no control over his character. That is not something that Milton will believe in. Milton just can't believe in that, because it's too important to him to think that change is always possible.
I read somewhere that I think maybe was Harold Bloom who says that Satan is a descendant of Iago, of Othello's Iago. Do you think that's right? Because in a way, what you were saying about Satan, something that we could say about Iago, the way in which he just plots and plots, and in the end, nothing matters, just like the plotting itself. And I was reminded of what Hannah Arendt wrote in Eichmann in Jerusalem in its postscript, that she says, there cannot be radical evil. And I was mistaken when I wrote that, because evil is, it seems that evil is groundless. And in a way, the dissolution of Satan is similar to the dissolution of Iago, in that they discovered that what they are doing is just filled with nothing.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I'm taking a couple of questions from that. And one of that is sort of moving us over to discuss Shakespeare, because I know that's where you want to go. I think, you know, Iago is indeed a model for Milton in a bunch of ways. And I think that one of the ways in which Milton builds Satan as a compelling character, and also Adam and Eve, is precisely by realizing that what the epic in the 17th century needed to make it modern and enliven it was drama, that it needed to become dramatic. And Milton clearly had read Shakespeare. In 2019, his copy of the First Folio was identified in Philadelphia. And it doesn't, of course, have, you know, the, you know, sort of life-changing notes that you want on it, you know, sort of like what you want him to have done is like circled Iago speeches and with a little annotation saying, must use this in something, you know, but there's nothing like that. But you can still, there's a lot of, you know, signs of engagement, just places where he's kind of scored the side to indicate, you know, sort of passages that he likes. But, you know, sort of, and there are, you know, lots of Shakespeare's works that appear throughout from the very beginning of his writing, echoes of them, that he learns so much from Shakespeare. And he learns, you know, about how to use language, about how to use blank verse, which is the form that he writes Paradise Lost in. He's, you know, he's clearly obsessed with some plays, especially some it's kind of harder to tell. And he is very interested in characters like Iago or Richard III, who, yes, you know, almost seem kind of pure evil, evil for evil's sake. And it has a certain kind of banality. I think the figure, the Shakespearean figure, however, and there's certainly a lot of markings on this play, the figure that is even more important for Satan is Macbeth. And Macbeth is obviously very different, because it's the story of someone who starts out actually as a pretty nice guy, you know, loyal retainer of Duncan. He's been fighting the battle, he's getting rewarded, family man, nice wife, well, you know, and good friend to Banquo. And it's, I mean, what really is interesting for both Shakespeare and Milton is watching how someone good can become evil, because that's the Satan story, and that's the story of the fall. And, you know, I think there are lots of, you know, sort of analogs in earlier literature as well that both Shakespeare and Milton are looking back to. It's kind of, you know, Martha Nussbaum has talked about this as the banal, or the fragility of goodness, and, you know, sort of that a good character who, you know, and how that really troubles us, that we think that good characters, no matter what happens, are going to stay good, but they don't. We think, you know, there must have been something wrong with Macbeth to begin with, or there must have been something wrong with Satan to begin with. But you know, sort of there are stories where circumstances, you know, sort of make people do just horrific things. And Macbeth, you know, sort of watching that transformation, I think is very important for Milton in thinking about Satan. And again, it comes back to your point, Nico, is that if Satan were just Iago, he might get a little bit wearing. But I think or Richard III, too. I mean, Richard III is kind of great for a play, but you wouldn't, you know, he can also get sort of, there's only so much you necessarily, you know, want of him. And it's an early play of Shakespeare. But Macbeth, just the tragedy. And that's, you know, Satan is a tragic figure. The tragedy of someone who, you know, has all this potential and clearly is smart, charismatic, brave, and has a lot of things that we admire, but then becomes this kind of machine of destruction. And he's the one who, he invents the cannonball in book six, you know, and, you know, just, you know, then becomes a snake too. So there is a sense that we're watching the kind of degradation of a character who keeps making these kind of disastrous life choices that end up destroying a lot of other people, but demeaning him at the same time. I mean, one thing that people often notice is that when Milton later wrote a kind of sequel to Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained, the Satan in it just doesn't seem compelling. And I think that's kind of, you know, the point, that he's become just this kind of figure of evil, that part of the, you know, drama of Paradise Lost is not just watching the fall of Adam and Eve, but watching the fall of Satan. And again, that's the interesting point, is the poem begins with Satan in hell, so it looks like he's fallen already, but it also suggests that he hasn't completely, which means that he might, you know, have still done something differently. But by choosing to tempt and destroy Adam and Eve, he's consolidating his own tragic end. So we're really seeing two tragedies, the tragedy of Satan, which, you know, sort of obviously for Nico is kind of the point of the poem, but the tragedy of Adam and Eve too is there. And then, and to a certain extent, we have a third one in the tragedy of the narrator, who, you know, sort of reminds us of, you know, he shares the consequences for this, that his life and his difficulty writing and his blindness, all of these things that he talks about, so much more than narrators were supposed to, that, you know, all of this is, we're all part of this story.
I will now, I take it on. You're right. Adam and Eve equally compelling, and the loss is very palpable. But I also, you know, in this reading, it's what you just said also stuck with me a lot, that it's like a constant fall, like Satan keeps falling. Like this ultimate moment when he's here to get his triumph and everyone's turned into a snake and is now hissing. It's so, I mean, it's almost funny, but it's tragic. And then The other thing, I found a line this time reading it that it stuck with me, when he's the snake, and it really kind of summarized the power of Satan in both his compelling nature, but also his danger. It said, it's when he's about to give the fruit, and it's like, he leading swiftly rolled in tangles and made intricate seem straight to mischief swift. And that is making intricate seem straight as an evil thing is so compelling. As a thing to be careful of.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think it because I mean, it's funny, you know, sort of, you know, it's good that you notice that line, because of course, you know, a lot of what we want to do is make intricate not seem straight, but be straight. We want to, you know, clarify things. And in a way, you know, sort of Milton is advocating complexity. And one of the things about paradise too is it's kind of tangled and everything is intricate, and it's got this river that winds through it, and it's got this lush grove, and it's this place of enormous growth and fertility, and Satan is the great kind of reducer of things in many ways, who appeals to, you know, sort of our desire to simplify. Maybe I'll take that as a justification for my messy office behind you, which maybe you'll see has got a snake up there.
I love that. Yeah, no, and actually this might be a good way to segue kind of into the final part of the conversation, I think. But I had asked you if you would read something, and you had told me maybe you would read the description of Eden. You'll read it, and then I hope that you can talk a little bit about how you read Milton, how you read blank verse, because I think that's a major hurdle for certain people, because people read poetry so poorly in school. It's what you and I talked about, like line by line by line, and it doesn't flow. And so we would love to hear you read some Milton. You've already read a little bit, but, you know, and then tell us how you read this, how to approach it, and why it works, or, you know, et cetera.
Well, I'll read a passage that describes Eden, and I think kind of itself is about what I'll say about how the verse flows, because it's a description of a river. One of the things that I will just say in advance is precisely, I hadn't really realized how much of a problem that this was until, you know, a student just said to me is that they were having difficulty with the verse, and I discovered that they would read a line and then stop and try to make sense of the line. And the problem is that, you know, sort of with Milton, the verse is itself very entangled and intricate, that he uses the form of blank verse, which hadn't been used much for poetry. It had been used primarily for drama with Shakespeare, and especially before him, Marlowe. And so that itself is a kind of dramatic, you know, sort of element. And one of the reasons it was used was precisely that it allows for more flexibility of movement. It's very good, of course, for soliloquies. I mean, imagine if you wrote to be or not to be in rhyme, that, you know, if you're trying to represent a mind that's moving freely, blank verse is very close to human speech. But it also does still have a form. So, you know, the other thing that can kind of intimidate people is that they look at Milton and they see these blocks of poetry, that they look like kind of monolithic pillars on the page there. And one of the things that you have to realize is that, you know, the line gives you a little bit of a boundary, but you can't, and you have to respect the boundary, but not kind of limit yourself with it. And I think that it's a form that very much reflects Milton's vision of Eden as a place that is perfect, partly because it's circumscribed for Adam and Eve, that, you know, that it gives them a kind of place where they know where they are, they're grounded, that we, you know, sort of humans need limits, but that those limits are not adamant. Paradise is surrounded by walls, but they're trees, or covered in trees. It's not quite clear. And, you know, it's not like that they're big brass walls or anything like that with a padlock, that it's all rather natural. And we're told that Adam and Eve are eventually going to expand beyond paradise. And in fact, and Milton makes a big deal of this, so it comes from Genesis, Adam is created outside of paradise and then brought in. So the inside and outside are kind of, you know, are linked to each other. But I think what Milton is trying to suggest is that there is a way in which we need some kind of sense of enclosure or boundary to work with. But it's a provisional one. And the line is doing that, so that when you read, you have to kind of note the line, but not worship it. I mean, and sort of just often you have to transgress and go beyond the line. So what I'll read is, this is in book four, a passage of description of Eden. In book four, Satan comes to the garden and enters it. So we come in, you know, sort of with him and move from the outside, you know, sort of towards a vision of the couple. But I'm just going to read a description of the landscape, because this comes back to, in a way, to the question of whether Milton succeeds in giving us a landscape that, or a world that is appealing enough for us to lament that it was lost. And I think, I guess my part of my point is, you know, sort of, it may not, you know, answer all of your dreams or, you know, anyone's dreams, but I think it's kind of clear what Milton is trying to, you know, suggest including in this garden, that, again, what I talked about, the sort of luxuriousness of it, the fertility, the intricateness of it. And it sort of really centers around this flowing river and the energy of the river as it moves through the garden. So this is in book four, line 223 following. I'll just take a bit of water before I start, because it's a long passage. And sometimes with Milton, with the long verse paragraphs, you don't get a chance to breathe for a while.
Yeah, prepare your voice like an actor, right, to read Milton.
Southward through Eden went a river large, nor changed his course, but through the shaggy hill passed underneath engulfed. For God had thrown that mountain as his garden mold, high raised upon the rapid current, which through veins of porous earth with kindly thirst updrawn, rose a fresh fountain, and with many a rill watered the garden. Thence united fell down the steep glade and met the nether flood, which from his darksome passage now appears, and now divided into four main streams, runs diverse, wandering many a famous realm and country, whereof here needs no account. But rather to tell how, if art could tell, how from that sapphire fount the crisped brooks, rolling on orient pearl and sands of gold, with mazy error under pendant shades ran nectar, visiting each plant, and fed flowers worthy of paradise, which not nice art embeds in curious knots, but nature boon poured forth profuse on hill and dale and plain. Both where the morning sun first warmly smote the open field, and where the unpierced shade embroomed the noontide bowers. Thus was this place a happy rural seat of various view, groves whose rich trees wept odorous gums and balm, others whose fruit burnished with golden rind hung amiable, Hesperian fables true, if true here only, and of delicious taste. Betwixt them lawns or level downs, and flocks grazing the tender herb were interposed, or palmy hillock, or the flowery lap of some irriguous valley spread her store, flowers of all hue, and without thorn the rose. Another side, umbrageous grots and caves of cool recess, o'er which the mantling vine lays forth her purple grapes, and gently creeps luxuriant. Meanwhile, murmuring waters fall down the slope hills, dispersed or in a lake, that to the fringed bank with myrtle crowned her crystal mirror holds unite their streams. The birds their choir apply, airs, vernal airs, breathing the smell of field and grove, attune the trembling leaves, while universal Pan, knit with the graces and the hours in dance, led on the eternal spring. So it goes on, but I'll just stop there. One of the reasons I chose this passage is that I think it's trying to use sound so much to convey what's important in Eden. And it's so much fun to read out loud, because you can say words like odorous gums and balm, or my favorite, umbrageous. It's not a word that I can get into conversation very often, and I think that my life is poorer because of it. it's a word that you want to go around saying all the time, umbrageous. It's just, it's so sensual. It's so, you know, you taste it. It means shady, of course, you know, from the Latin word umbra, which we get umbrella there. But it's just such a wonderful word here. And, you know, the idea that, you know, things are, there's the nectar, it's weeping nectar, it's oozing. The language itself is oozing. It's like the words are oozing over the line there. That this is a world that is so full and sensual pleasure. There's a focus on all of the senses, the oral sense through the sound, the image there of, you know, the waters and the gold and the pearl. It's rich in every sense. You can almost taste it, I think, is partly with that, those words there, that it's a very, very bodily, you know, sort of experience, that this is not a, you know, sort of pure, you know, sort of puritanical. Milton is not a Puritan, despite his reputation, that this is not a puritanical place, and Milton insists, something that would have been quite shocking to, you know, some of his readers, that there is sex in the garden. Adam and Eve are naked. They're, you know, sex is an important part of their life. Food is an important part of their life. The birds and the animals are important, the fruit, that this is a garden of earthly delights. And, you know, sort of it's the water flowing through it. I think, you know, obviously in a literal way, it just means that they've always got water, that the earth is very fertile, but just has this sense of fullness. And also I think the water that flows has a sense of a certain kind of freedom. And this is really back to, you know, Nico's point about Satan making intricate seem straight. This is a world where you don't make intricate seem straight, where the intricacies are allowed to be intricate, where the water kind of, you know, trills around in different places, where, you know, things are kind of tangled, the mantling vine creeping, that things are, it's a very symbiotic world. You know, there are lots of interesting ways in which you can read Milton's description of the relationship between Adam and Eve to the natural world in relationship to current environmental concerns, you know, too, just that... that there is this kind of interplay and exchange between the human and the natural, that, you know, yes, Genesis says that Adam and Eve have dominion over the garden, but what that means in Milton is not, you know, instrumentalize the garden and just use it. They have responsibilities and a kind of you know, relationship with the natural world. When they, in book five, they get up in the morning, the first thing that they do is they sing to God, which of course is very nice for God and very flattering, but I think also tells us that an important part for a paradise for Milton is that Adam and Eve have to be creative. They have to be poets, and they speak to each other in a way that's very poetically. They address each other in a way that's formal, that they don't just call each other by name, that they have, you know, kind of long phrases that they use, you know, sort of about their relationship. And that it's very important for Milton that they are not just God's creations, but that they are also creators in their own right, that they are in the garden, that they are working the garden, and that they are able to sing to repay God for what he's given them. But in the song, they invite all of the elements and the animals to join them. So it's not just, you know, sort of that creativity is not confined to the human world. It's also part of everything, that everything is kind of made in God's image. Also, you know, that you know, the river here, I mean, the river is itself a kind of work of art, with its sapphire found, orient pearl, sands of gold, and everything is purely natural, but also kind of infused with this creative and imaginative energy. And so that's the other side of the kind of physicality here. There's both, this has to be a sensual universe grounded in physical pleasure, but that also there has to be imaginative pleasure as well, an outlet, that it's a very intelligent and alive, animate world.
I want to ask you something about what you say about Milton's alleged Puritanism.
Right.
So what was his religion? What do we know about his religion?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, one of the problems with the term Puritan is that it was frequently used in the 17th century just basically as a derogatory term against, you know, anyone who kind of thought they were better than other people because they were more spiritual, and that could be Catholics as well as Protestants. But there were, you know, sort of radical Protestants who were what we would identify now in a kind of loose way as Puritans. Milton was not one of them. Milton's religion is appropriately kind of idiosyncratic and, like the river here, intricate. You know, he was raised in a household that was Protestant, but Protestantism itself was kind of changing at this point. And one of the big, you know, motivators behind the Civil War was precisely a sense of the question of what direction English Protestantism should go in, because, as you know, the Reformation is still relatively new in England. There's still an awful lot of Catholics. There are a lot of people who are sort of going back into Catholicism too. That, you know, Charles I's wife is a Catholic, that some of the aristocratic families, especially in the north, are Catholics. And, you know, so there's part of the church who wants to kind of make the Protestant church a little bit more like the Catholic, which, you know, has its advantages, despite, you know, aside from doctrinal things. And then there are the more radical groups who come out of the Calvinist tradition and are beginning themselves to kind of splinter into different independents. And these are, you know, sort of many of the soldiers and also leaders in the army who have different ideas. And there can be quite a variety there. And then amongst those group, you have Presbyterians who are kind of, you know, sort of in the middle between the, you know, sort of the Church of England types who are beginning to think more about, you know, or seem to be following Catholicism, even though they say they're not, and the independents. So there's a lot of heated discussion. And I mean, this is part of the background to both the revolution and also why the revolution failed, because the Revolutionary Party was not unified in its beliefs. And so, as so often, the revolution devours itself, that they were turning amongst themselves, and because they couldn't agree on things, in a way, that's, you know, sort of Cromwell's justification for why he increasingly took more power, is just because of the incoherence of his followers. No one liked the king, or very few, you know, people, and certainly not those who overthrew him. But beyond that, they really hadn't thought about much else. So Milton grows up in a family that is Protestant at a time when Protestantism is still allows for a certain element, a certain variety. But when he's in his 20s, factions begin to develop, and people gradually are being forced to make choices. Are you someone who wants to go with the king and his side, who are making the church more like the Church of England, I think, today, and, you know, sort of that's got more ceremony, that's a little bit more like the Catholic Church to be, or are you going more in the other direction? And Milton, at some point, we don't know exactly when and we don't know why, starts moving towards the other side. I mean, certainly by the 1640s, he does. But because that other side is so factionalized, he doesn't find a niche, so he doesn't fit in. He eventually, the group of Presbyterians he really falls, he had hopes with for at the beginning, he falls out with, and increasingly become the object of his loathing. And he has some affinities with some of the radical groups, and this has been argued, you know, by, you know, scholars have been interested in his overlaps. But I think the, you know, sort of the basic fact is that, you know, he was one of the Protestants who believed that it should be, he was an independent in the sense that he believed that that religion should be between the individual and God, and that religious faith should be based on scripture and not, as it was in the Catholic Church and in the Church of England as it developed, on the institutionalization of the religion, that the sort of institutionalization of religion concerned him. He had, and this is just, you know, kind of obvious in many ways for a young man of his generation, he had been planning on becoming a clergyman of some sort. His father was a lawyer and middle class. And although, you know, his father's name was John Milton too, but he didn't force his son to, you know, follow in his footsteps, for which Milton was grateful. But clearly he thought the right profession, because it was for a young man who was very smart, good at languages, was the clergy. And, you know, he could serve God, he could help his country, he could have status, all of these things. It would have been ideal for him. And when he went to Cambridge at university, he went thinking that that's where he would end up. But for different reasons, and it may have been that most of his classmates were going to be clergymen, and he wasn't really impressed by the depth of their religious belief, he decided not to. He decided to become a poet instead, which is kind of insane at any time, but, you know, then too. And he also decided very much that a paid clergy was an evil, because the minute you start kind of mixing religion with business, I guess I'd say that, you know, sort of making ministers, you know, sort of paying ministers, is it kind of, you know, ruins the whole thing, because ministers then just are basically serving their own, they're trying to fill their own pockets. And of course, you know, this is a time, and it continues for a long time, of many abuses of that, you know, sort of people who would have multiple, you know, sort of parishes and get enormous incomes from them. So, you know, it could, you know, being a minister could be a very lucrative business. And that really disgusted Milton and turned him off the whole institution of religion. So his religious beliefs, I mean, you know, there's certain things that, certain aspects we can say, oh, in this respect he's this, in this respect he's that, but he's basically John Milton.
I also wanted to ask you something about the way the poem was read at the beginning, because we know that Shakespeare, for example, wasn't meant to be read by people in their houses. That came later. What about Milton? What were the patterns of reading his poems after his death, or just by the time that the books were published?
Well, you know, so he only had one volume of poetry before Paradise Lost, which didn't sell all that well, but it was published in 1645. And, you know, this was during, you know, sort of a period of unrest. And he was competing with some other really good poets who were coming out and were very popular. Paradise Lost, when it came out, of course, I mean, well, one of the things that we have to remember is that, okay, even with his early poems, Milton didn't publish a lot. And what he had published in the early 1640s and then through the 1650s were political works, because he had worked for the government. So he was known as a political figure and not as a poet. And this did color his reception enormously. And in a way, I think, you know, sort of helped influence how he presents himself as a poet as well. But he was clearly, I mean, even by people who disagreed with him politically and thought that, you know, his political work, some of his political works were burned after the Restoration, and some people would have burned Milton too, or had him executed, because they felt that he was he'd been involved in the regicide and he should be punished as well. But most, you know, most English at that point were just trying not to kill more people, that there'd been enough bloodshed. But, you know, when Paradise Lost came out, Milton had a reputation as, you know, someone who's very learned, but rather controversial. But also too, it came out at a time when, as I said, the epic was really considered something, you know, that belonged to an earlier, darker age, that the form blank verse was not something that was, you know, was not the kind of, it was not the verse form that was in at the time, which were rhyming couplets. And Milton really stands out. I mean, the poet who's going to become the, you know, most successful poet and playwright of this period is John Dryden, who doesn't write all in rhyming couplets, but does write in rhyming couplets, and actually asked Milton if he could do a verse form, a play form, in partly in rhyming couplets of Paradise Lost, which Milton said he could do, and he did. And it's very interesting to compare the two of them. So Milton's was really kind of strikingly kind of unfashionable. And I think it was read with curiosity, with great admiration, but also just a little bit of a feeling like this was part of the old world, you know, sort of that, you know, it wasn't immediately apparent that this was really going to be the great work that it was. It happened fairly quickly, actually. People began to recognize just how important it was, about what an achievement it was. But it's often, you know, through other writers themselves too, who find works of art inspiring and want to respond to them. And in that, you know, for, you know, both Milton and Shakespeare in the 18th century, both Milton and Shakespeare, you know, become in different ways kind of venerated as the great writers of their time. But you know, of course they start to become characterized in different ways. And Milton is this kind of sort of strange, archaic thing that seems to belong to a past world, while Shakespeare, you know, seems, you know, always to be a little bit more compatible with modernity, whenever modernity is, if it's the 18th century or the 20th century. Though a lot of the versions of Shakespeare after the Restoration, of course, completely rewrite Shakespeare. You're probably aware of, you know, the very famous version of King Lear, which has a happy ending, which, sort of other versions of plays that kind of change them to make them more compatible with the time. So there's, you know, sort of, so Milton becomes, you know, sort of fairly early on recognized as this, you know, major achievement. But I think there also is what's sort of paradoxical is there is this feeling that Milton has done something. And partly because he's done it, no one else can ever do it again. That, you know, there's the feeling that no one can write an epic after Milton. In fact, you know, the idea that no one can write an epic after someone who's written an epic can be traced back to Homer. You know, so it's, you know, we shouldn't get too excited about that. And Milton clearly did inspire less, you know, attempts at other epics, because the 18th century was not really, it did mock epic, of course, which, you know, Milton was useful for. But where Milton really, as I've already suggested, becomes kind of a muse is for the novel, the sense that, you know, sort of his putting a couple and domesticity, a couple as opposed to the Virgilian lone ranger, Aeneas. You know, Aeneas famously, he loses his wife in Troy. He has to leave behind his lover Dido in Carthage. You know, that, you know, sort of the epic hero, with the important exception of Odysseus, Ulysses, The epic hero can't have a family. And see, that's where James Bond went wrong in the last movie when he tried to have a family. And then he had to die, of course, because that's just impossible. But you know, sort of in the novel, that's going to be the bread and butter, the relationship between men and women, the misunderstanding, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, and, you know, then the reunion. It's fascinating, of course, just to see how Milton was read at different times and, you know, read less at others, at some than others. Who reads him? I think, you know, one thing I do find really, you know, sort of wonderful is that he often is a work that people sort of stumble across outside of the academy and want to read because they've kind of heard about it and they've heard that it's terrifying or, you know, this or that. And they want to read it and they get hooked on it. And I think it's simply at the level of language before you even fully understand what it is. It sounds good. And especially, you know, sort of if you can read it out loud to yourself. So I think that's, you know, sort of people keep on coming back to it, and it can speak to different, you know, sort of generations, and often, you know, in very, very different ways.
Maggie, this is amazing. I know Andres has to go, but I don't know if you want to say anything else to conclude, even if he has to go, or...
I should probably go and see if there's...
to still have a home.
Yes. Maggie, thank you. This was insanely interesting. I will take you up on, we should do a cycle on Virgil, although I have to brush up on my Virgil. Thank you so much for doing this, for your time, for introducing so many people to this incredible work. And thank you.
Yeah, thanks both of you. It was fun. And actually good for my brain to kind of get off, you know, sort of dog training for a few minutes. I feel fun. Okay. So we'll see. I'll see you guys later for Virgil.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, Maggie.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Bye.